Fritz Cadrone is the editor of the book Refusnik, Israel's Soldiers of Conscience. Fritz Cadrone was born in Vienna in 1933, months after the Nazi occupation of Austria. His family fled to Britain. On graduation from high school, he immigrated to Israel, where he lived for 20 years in Zakim, a border kibbutz near the Gaza Strip, where he grew oranges, taught in a school, and engaged in voluntary work. A freelance journalist, broadcaster, and writer, he has translated many books, including the memoirs of Yitzhak Rabin and Ezer Weizman, and a biography of David Ben-Gurion. In 1976, he co-authored with the Palestinian activist Raymonda Tawil her memoirs, My Home, My Prison. In the late 1960s, he became active in the radical left and the peace movement. He is a founder of the Israeli Council for Israeli-Palestinian Peace and serves on the steering committee of the human rights watchdog B'Tselem. Having refused to perform military duty in the occupied Palestinian territories, he now handles international contacts for Yesh Gavul. Founded at the time of the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, the group has become the voice and campaigning vehicle for the so-called refuseniks, Israeli army reservists who report for duty when summoned but refuse morally objectionable assignments, notably serving in the West Bank and Gaza. And I'm very pleased to be joined by Peretz Cadrone, editor of the book Refuseniks, from his home in Israel to talk about the political situation there as well as the situation in Lebanon and Gaza. Hello, Peretz. Are you there?
I am. Hello, Santa Cruz.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Peretz. Really appreciate it. So why don't we begin by talking about the political situation in Israel. The government there is coming under some heavy criticism from the left and the right. Can you talk about what those criticisms are from both of those perspectives?
Yeah, we're living very much with a fallout from the war. And put simply, the right wing complained that the war wasn't conducted ferociously enough, wasn't allowed to continue to the end. The idea was that if they'd been given a few more days, they could have crushed Hezbollah, or so at least some of the military claim. And there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the way the military and political leadership conducted the war, and calls for resignation or for a commission of inquiry to show how the generals and the politicians conducted the war. Now, new voices are beginning to be heard, which weren't heard during the war when everyone was sort of marching in lockstep. But now we're beginning to hear a lot of questions about why the war was launched at all, because none of the virtually none of the professed aims was achieved. The two Israeli soldiers taken prisoner by Hezbollah are still in Hezbollah hands. Hezbollah hasn't been destroyed, etc. So the war aims weren't achieved, and there's dissatisfaction and criticism for launching such a destructive campaign. Just to give you an idea, the Israeli casualties included 160 fatalities, which relative to population is 2.5 times the casualties the U.S. has suffered so far in the entire Iraqi campaign. 2.5 times as high. And of course, the damage and devastation on the Lebanese side is 10 times, if not more, worse than that, and huge destruction. On both sides, there's been huge economic disruption of the of everything, the tourist industry, physical infrastructure, great damage on both sides. And people are beginning to ask, what was the point of the exercise? Why did the Israeli government leap into this adventure?
So you basically have, on the right, a criticism that the Israeli military and government didn't handle the war as ferociously as they should have. They should have been more aggressive. And then on the left, you have more of a critique of why did we even launch this incredibly destructive attack, especially considering that the original aims were not met, which was getting back the two soldiers that were being held by Hezbollah, and then later the statement that they were going to wipe Hezbollah off the map, or at least out of southern Lebanon. You're saying those aims were not accomplished?
Certainly. And in addition, we're beginning to get reports like the investigation conducted by the U.S. journalist Timur Hirsch, who claims that the Israeli campaign was actually pre-planned quite a long time ahead. It wasn't a spontaneous reaction to the Hezbollah attack in which these two soldiers were taken prisoner and eight others killed. He claims that the plan had been set out and had been cleared with the Americans weeks ahead of the incident, and that in effect the Israeli military was just waiting for an opportunity to spring this attack. And that is also, by the way, the claim coming from Nasrallah, the head of the Hezbollah, who says that they were sure that the Israeli attack would come sometime in August and September. That may not be entirely fanciful.
You say that was reported by Seymour Hirsch. Wasn't it also reported in Israeli papers like Haaretz that this was a pre-planned thing, that it would have taken many, many months or years to plan this action, that it could never have been pieced together as quickly as it was without some major preparation?
Well, this in itself doesn't say a great deal, because theoretically every army is supposed to prepare dozens of contingency plans for all sorts of eventualities. But the claim here, which is only just beginning to filter through into the Israeli media, was that this plan was actually practiced, that there were actual preparations, meaning that it wasn't just something that was laid aside in some bottom drawer collecting dust. This was in actual preparation. So all this seems to come together to suggest that the Israeli military had in mind an attack with the aim of destroying Hezbollah and its bases in southern Lebanon.
What about the economic damage that has resulted from the war? I understand that that's another source of some political turmoil in Israel at the moment.
Yes, you have to bear in mind that we have a new government, which was elected a few months ago, with a program of improving social services, welfare, education, and so on. And the idea was to channel funds away from military expenditure into these social programs. All that is gone by the board because the military is now demanding huge sums of money to make up for what it spent on the war, the munitions that were fired off, of course, pretty expensive pieces of equipment, and they have to be replaced. And in addition, all these omissions, the fact that the soldiers reported for duty and there wasn't the equipment to supply them with, all that has to be made up. So the army is asking for large sums of money, and if those sums are indeed put into the military budget, they'll be lacking from the social services. And there's already talk of cutting back on education, teachers are being fired and so on, and of course there's a very difficult situation in our health services. So that comes, of course, on top of the actual physical damage caused by the Hezbollah rocket attacks, which caused a great deal of devastation, and houses and factories and so on that need to be repaired. And that, again, is a major item of expenditure.
I'm sure that there are plenty of folks on the right there who would say, well, who's to blame for the economic damage? They would, of course, say it was Hezbollah and that it was their rocket attacks and their cross-border raid that created this whole situation. So if you're going to point fingers or complain about the economic situation or the loss of life, that you should be criticizing Hezbollah, not the Israeli government. How would you respond to that?
Well, that can be quite accurate because we just had the publication of the National Insurance Institute, which is our equivalent of your Social Security, and they've just published a report for the past year which shows that a huge number of Israelis, 1.6 million Israelis out of a population of 7 million, only over 20%, live below the poverty line. One child in three in Israel lives in a household below the poverty line. And old people are also extremely vulnerable to withdrawal of social services. So the social situation was pretty dire beforehand, and this was shown up during the fighting, rather in a way that the social situation in New Orleans was shown up by Hurricane Katrina. There were these, thousands, tens of thousands of people living in shelters for weeks on end, and it was the government was completely helping in providing services, feeding basic things like food and water. And essentially, if it hadn't been for voluntary associations and all sorts of kinds of charitable gifts, people would simply have been left starving.
But didn't the war make the economic situation worse? And can't that be laid at the feet of Hezbollah? We already had a bad situation economically in Israel and then was made worse by this war. And aren't they responsible?
It was indeed made worse by the war. Then the question is, who's responsible for the war? But aside from that, what the war did was to highlight an existing situation which is getting worse. This report I just mentioned by the National Insurance Institute about the poverty in Israel shows that an extra 100,000 people were shunted below the poverty line in this past year. Half of them children, which means that the situation was getting worse anyway because of the ongoing government policy and the economic situation, and the war simply showed up the plight these people were in.
So you're saying there's no, that Israelis who were angry with Hezbollah and might hold them partly to blame for an already deteriorating situation getting worse are not directing their anger in the right place?
Well, certainly not, particularly if we take into account the fact that, which seems to be pretty clear now, that the offensive against Hezbollah had been planned for a long time and was actually cleared with the Americans long before the border incident that supposedly sparked the conflict.
How do you think the Israeli government should have responded? You clearly think that their actions were incorrect. What do you think should have been the response to this taking of the two Israeli soldiers, the crossing of the border by Hezbollah? What should they have done?
Well, the criticism is, first of all, about inaction. It's 6 years since Israel pulled out of Lebanon. Over that period, there's been no attempt at any kind of diplomatic initiative to resolve Israel's conflict with Lebanon and with the other neighboring country outside Syria. And in fact, we know that a senior Israeli official, the former National Security Advisor, General Eiland, put forward a plan a few months ago for a diplomatic initiative to try and defuse the situation on the northern border by approaching Syria and trying to restart peace talks, and his proposal was turned down. So first of all, it's a matter of inaction, allowing a dangerous situation to fester and get worse, which created the which set the power blockade going. Then the question is how Israel could have responded to the Hezbollah attack. Well, technically, of course, Hezbollah were the ones that opened fire, and they can be held accountable for that. But the Israeli response was totally disproportionate to it was a very grave provocation, certainly. But the Israeli reaction, in which over 1,000 Lebanese civilians, nobody knows yet how long the casualty list is, but at least 1,000 Lebanese civilians were killed in the Israeli attack, and the devastation in Lebanon is enormous. So the Israeli response was totally disproportionate, and we're left. Israel didn't achieve the war aims by force, namely releasing the two soldiers captured by Hezbollah. Israel will now have to do what it could have done before the fighting started, namely negotiated a prisoner exchange deal by which Israel would have released the Lebanese prisoners it holds in its prisons in exchange for these soldiers. And that's exactly what we're going to have to do now, and that could have been done without all the bloodshed and havoc. The issues, I stress again, the outstanding issues between Israel and Lebanon are really not large. There's practically no territorial dispute except this very small piece of land. And there are no claims from either side. So So it looks as though this is something that could have been resolved if there had been the political will on the Israeli side to try and reach agreement, first with Syria and secondly with Lebanon. And that could have been done over these past years. At least efforts could have been made instead of this total paralysis, the total silence, total rejection of any overtures. And there have been overtures. The Syrian president has said several times that he would like to renew peace talks. And there was no response from the Israeli side. So this is the basic criticism of the Israeli position.
I'm sure a lot of folks in Israel would argue that there's no point in talking with someone, a group like Hezbollah, because they're just a fundamentalist terrorist organization that is bent on destruction of Israel, and therefore what's the point in talking with them? They're unreasonable.
Yeah, well, we've heard that argument before. Just let me remind you, I'm familiar with Israeli history. And in the 60s, we were told there was no point in speaking with Nasser because he was tied to the destruction of Israel. Then we were told there was no point in speaking to Sadat because he came with peace offers, and he was considered too weak. And then after we made peace with Egypt, in spite of that, with that self-same Sadat, we couldn't speak to the PLO because they were terrorists, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And then when that was overcome, then there was no point in speaking with Arafat because Arafat was shifty. And then there's no point in speaking to the Assad, the first president, Assad, the father of the president, because he was too tough. And then there's no point in speaking to the present president because he's too weak. So every time we get this same refrain, irrespective of who it is on the other side, we're always told that there's no point in speaking. And when you hear that same refrain repeated over and over again in entirely different circumstances, you begin to suspect that maybe there's a reluctance to conduct any kind of equitable negotiations with any of the neighboring Arab countries. And this is, the underlying criticism of Israeli policy over decades.
So I'd like to talk about the book that you edited, Refusnik, Israel's Soldiers of Conscience. But I want to give you a chance before we move on to talking about the book to say anything more you'd like to say about the current situation there in Israel at the moment.
No, but wait, we should tie it in by saying that that when the army called in reserves to launch this campaign into Lebanon, there were a number of soldiers who refused to take part and were sent to prison for that refusal. And this follows a familiar pattern which has existed now for over 30 years, where soldiers, reservists or conscripts, refuse on grounds of conscience and political outlook, refuse to take part in campaigns they consider unworthy. Don't forget, the Israeli army is called the Israel Defense Force. And the claim is that anything that needs to be done for the defense of Israel is legitimate, but occupying Palestinian land and taking part in the repression of the Palestinian population or invading Lebanon has nothing to do with the defense of Israel. This is aggressive action which ultimately doesn't benefit Israel. On the contrary, causes enormous damage to Israel. And that's really the background to the Refusnik movement, which I tried to feature in this book by the collecting declarations of Refusniks, of soldiers who were tried for a refusal to serve either in the First Lebanon War or in the occupied territories. And each one there gives his reasons for that refusal.
I want to remind folks you're listening to 101.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Right now I'm speaking with Peretz Kedron. He is the editor of the book Refusnik, Israel's Soldiers of Conscience. He also serves on the steering committee of the human rights watchdog group B'Tselem in Israel. He is also one of the international contacts for Yesh Gavul, which is a group that supports refuseniks, so-called refuseniks, Israeli Army reservists, who report for duty when summoned but refuse morally objectionable assignments, notably in the West Bank and Gaza. So you've compiled in this book the stories of ordinary foot soldiers from every ethnic background and class. Can you talk about some of the stories that are presented in this book, some of the reasons that people have for refusing?
One of the amazing things is the enormous variety of reasons that people have. In fact, I was astounded myself. I didn't find two declarations that were in any way similar. We have people who grew up in far-right families. We have people from the far left. We have Zionists and anti-Zionists. We have religious, non-religious, anti-religious. Each individual there presents his reasons. I stress his, because at that time, almost all the refuseniks were men. Since the book came out, there have been quite a number of women refuseniks as well. But at the time the book was published, there were no, or one or two women refuseniks, so I didn't take their testimonies. So each one gives his reasons for refusal, why he finds that particular assignment immoral, illegitimate, harmful to Israel and to its neighbors. And as I say, there is no similarity. You won't find any two declarations that are in any way similar. And that's one of the amazing things about the refusing movement, which is essentially a movement of individuals. Each individual refuses on his own. You don't march down a street with 10,000 refuseniks. You report for duty and you stand up before your commanding officer and you're told to go somewhere and you say, I refuse this assignment because it goes against my moral principles. And then you're on your own and you're on your own in the military trial. So it's very much an individual act of conscience, which, however, when it comes into these numbers, and my reckoning very roughly is that over the past 30 years, there have been 4,000 Israelis, or possibly more, 4,000 who have refused to take part in what they consider to be immoral or illegitimate actions of the Israeli army, mainly having to do with the occupation of the Palestinian lands, but also the campaigns in Lebanon.
From the book, it appears that a good percentage of these refuseniks had served in the occupied territories at some point, and that was a big part of things they had witnessed there was a big part of their reasoning in refusing to continue. So can you talk about some of the experiences they had that may have changed their views while they were there in the occupied Palestinian territories?
Well, usually what happened was, this is a very difficult process. It's very difficult for a soldier who's been trained to take part in military activities, to obey orders, to be part of the chain of command. And by the way, I should mention, it's not just ordinary foot soldiers. This goes up to quite high ranks, up to major, captain in the various arms of the army. They've all been trained to obey orders. They've all done military service and have been part of the military. So it doesn't come easily to turn around and say, no, I refuse. And it's usually a long process of wrestling with your conscience and the social pressures that you come under until you reach that final decision, okay, so far, no further. That, by the way, is the meaning of the term yesh gvul, which is Hebrew for something like, well, what they say in Italian is basta. You know, I've had enough, so far, no further. And it's usually a very long and painful process that may last several years, in the course of which the individual may have done several tours of duty in the occupied territories and is more and more disillusioned and turned off by what he sees and what he's required to do. And then finally, he reaches a point where he absolutely refuses to go back and do any more of this. And the reasons can be the final straw, the last straw that pushes people over the edge. In the book, you'll find my own story. What pushed me over the edge was seeing a bulldozer uproot a grove of almond trees. And at a time when I happened to be, my own job at the time was growing fruit trees, and seeing this outrage of a beautiful grove of almond trees that had been grown with great care and attention in a desert, in the Sinai desert. And these trees were callously uprooted to make room for a Jewish settlement, contrary to Israel's image of turning the desert into a blooming garden. Here, this was turning a blooming garden back into desert. That was what made me snap. And other people have seen instances of brutalization, of bullying of Palestinians, of various forms of injustice, which all come naturally with the occupation. Any occupation regime is naturally brings with it instances of tyrannical, illogical, immoral behavior, because that's part of the occupation. The occupation is an act of violence in itself, is an act of violence against the population that's occupied. And that large, that major act of violence enfolds within it dozens, hundreds, thousands of minor acts of tyranny, of injustice towards individuals and families and the entire communities. So there are plenty to see that can finally convince you that this is something you don't want to have any part in.
You mentioned the social pressures for people who choose this path, how they struggle with that. And I noticed in the book that quite a few of the refuseniks write about that or speak about it. Can you talk about some of those pressures and how hard it is for people to take a stand like this?
Well, the Israeli like most armies, the Israeli army occupies a sort of sanctified, hallowed place in Israeli society. But I would say the Israeli army, particularly if we go back to the early years of the refusnik movement, at that time, this was the first generation after the Holocaust, after the creation of Israel, and the army occupied a very special sanctified place, and therefore to go against it really went against the grain to put yourself in a conflict so-called with the army. Of course, the conflict isn't with the army. The conflict is with a political leadership that directs the army. But that's very difficult. It's very difficult to put yourself in conflict with your buddies that you've served with in the same outfit, because when you say, I'm not going, and these guys are going, in effect, you're accusing them. You're pointing the finger at them. And of course, they are very unhappy about being put in this position, and they express that. You have difficulties with your family. There are cases of refuseniks that were cut off by their own parents. Just a minor case in this recent conflict, one of the officers that refused to serve in Lebanon was sent to prison. He asked his parents to look after his dog while he was for these 4 weeks that he was in prison, and they refused because they were so outraged by the his action in refusing to serve. And that's just a minor instance. But there are pressures of all kinds. When I was wrestling with the issue, I had to deal with the fact that I had two teenage children growing up in a kibbutz where the tradition was very strong, and I had to bear in mind that if I refused and this was published, it would be very tough on my kids. So this is one of the things that made me hang back for a long time. So there are all kinds of pressures. The Israeli society is very compulsive. There are many ways of exerting pressure. Just the mere fact of knowing that you're going to have to stand trial and maybe spend some time in prison is not the worst of the obstacles that you have to deal with in becoming a refusnik. You have to deal with your entire social circle.
You say there's about 4,000 refuseniks at the moment?
No, I'm saying that over the years, Since the early 70s, when the refusnik movement began, my reckoning is that there have been approximately 4,000 individuals who have refused an assignment on moral or political grounds. Many of them, of course, are now over age, like myself. I'm no longer in the army.
Right.
But that's a rough number. Nobody has any clear figures because the army obviously doesn't publish figures, and when they do, we usually don't trust them because the army tends to play down the whole issue. But by a rough reckoning, that's the number. Approximately 1,000, or probably more by now, have been to prison. That means people were in prison for refusing to obey orders, for deliberately flouting orders and refusing to take these assignments, which they considered to be immoral and illegal.
How many of the refuseniks have been more senior military officials? I mean, I've heard of some rather high-ranking people who have made this choice.
Well, there was a very famous case when the refusing movement picked up in the first Lebanon War in 1982, at the time that Yesh Gvul was founded, and there was a first wave, mass wave of refusals from below. In fact, the refusals were on such a scale that the army refrained from calling up a battalion of paratroopers because they knew that there was a large number of potential refuseniks there. The most famous case was of a colonel, Elie Geva, who refused to lead an armored column into Beirut in the first Lebanon War. He wasn't actually refusing, but he wasn't prepared to command the brigade as it went into Beirut. He didn't refuse to serve. He said he'd drive a tank, but he refused to take responsibility. And because of that refusal, that particular attack was called off. So that's the most famous case, and that's the most highest ranking. But then just a couple of years ago, we had another very influential case when 27 pilots of the Air Force signed a joint letter in which they declared that they'd refused to take part in any further operations against Palestinian targets. And the Air Force here, as in most countries, is the elite of the armed forces. So the fact that the refusing movement penetrated into the highest ranks, the most select force of the Israeli army, had a very powerful effect on public opinion. And there's also a belief that this was one of the main reasons why that persuaded Ariel Sharon, the former prime minister, to make a 180-degree turn and decide to pull out of Gaza, which was something that he'd refused to do outright until that point. And he suddenly switched direction, and that came within days of this letter from the 27 pilots. So it has a very strong effect. The refusing movement has a powerful effect on the peace movement in general, as a catalyst and as a sort of ginger to move other groups. But it also has a direct effect on the decision makers, because they rely on the army being a military machine. When the military machine refuses to act like a machine, and elements of that machine begin to ask questions and begin to dispute policy, then that machine is no longer reliable, and then they have to change policy.
And of course, we're only talking about the refuseniks, folks who are out front about the fact that they're refusing. There's also a high number of Israelis. Everyone there is required to sign up for some kind of service, military service, and if not that, some kind of civil service, I guess, right? Everyone's required to do that when they come of a certain age.
Well, everyone's required. There's very little in the way of civil service. It's only in special cases.
But so for the most part, you have to go into the military in Israel when
That's
you
right.
become
That's
18,
right.
I would think. 18 is the age?
Yeah, the 18 is the age when men go in for 3 years, women go in for two, and I'm referring to Jewish men. Don't forget that 20% of the Israeli population are Arabs, and they aren't to conscription. But as far as Jews are concerned, that's the standard procedure. And then, having completed that period of service, they're then moved to the reserves, and they're required to do annual reserve duties, usually about a month a year, for 20 or 25 years after that, until their 40s.
Uh-huh. There's a fair number of Israelis, and it's hard to say exactly how many, that simply find a way to avoid going into the military. They're kind of, often their reasons are the same or similar to the refuseniks, but they're not making it public. They're just saying,
exactly.
You know, they're finding some way, like saying they're a drug addict or saying they're crazy or saying they, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
They find some way to avoid it, and that's not really recorded.
We call that gray refusal, which of course is very difficult to pinpoint. It's very difficult to know whether people have been released for on medical or psychiatric grounds, whether that is authentic or just a way of evading service. But it's in a way the overt refusing movement is the tip of the iceberg, and so as refusals, the overt refusals increase, there's also an increase in the gray refusal, because it reflects a general disillusionment with the military campaign, a general reluctance, and so many more soldiers, many more than the number of outspoken refuseniks, find some way of not taking part in the campaign.
I traveled there last year, in November of last year, and I spent several weeks in the West Bank working with Israeli, Palestinian, and international peace activists, and I met a lot of Israelis in that area, and they had all found a way to avoid military service, but they had and they did it because of their objections to their moral objections to what the Israeli army was doing in the occupied territories. I mean, some of them may have had even deeper reasons, say pacifist type reasons, but most of them had done it because they objected to the behavior of the Israeli army against Palestinians, and particularly in the occupied territories. So I got the impression, and none of them had done this publicly. They had always all found some way to avoid it, and they said all their friends had done the same. So anyway, I don't know what the percentage is, but I definitely met people, quite a few people who had found a way to simply stay out of the military.
I should mention at one point you speak about pacifists. There are pacifists. There's a small pacifist movement in Israel. But the overwhelming majority of the refuseniks are political refusals, namely people who are not pacifists in principle. I mean, in given circumstances, say if Israel were the victim of aggression, they would have no objection to defending Israel. That is a legitimate action. That is a legitimate duty of the Israeli army. They object to a specific assignment, a specific duty or specific campaign on political and moral grounds. But the overwhelming majority are not pacifists.
We only have 5 minutes left, and I have a couple more questions. I'm wondering, this group of refuseniks is fairly small, at least the public, kind of publicly seen refuseniks, the ones who do it openly and sometimes or often go to jail and suffer, you know, social ostracism and that kind of thing. They are a relatively small group when compared to the whole of the Israeli society and the Israeli military, correct?
Correct. Just as the number of actual draft resistors during the Vietnam War period in the United States, the actual number of draft resistors wasn't huge compared to the number who actually served, but they had an enormous impact. In both cases, it's a question of the political leadership no longer being able to rely on the army to automatically obey orders. When you get soldiers who begin to ask questions about the orders that they're given and to question the legitimacy of the assignment and the duties that they've been given, that begins to have a political impact. And let me quote to you, in 1984, in the first Lebanon War, after a couple of years of campaigning, the Israeli army recommended a pullback, more or less to end the campaign, which had taken them throughout most of Lebanon. And the army recommended ending that, and that recommendation was adopted by the cabinet. Now, the commander-in-chief of the army at that time was a general, Moshe Levy, and he was asked afterwards why they made that recommendation, why they recommended ending the campaign. And he gave a number of reasons. One of them is significant to what we're talking about. He said, at that time, refusals were running in the tens and hundreds. And we were afraid that if we continued the campaign, refusals would run into the thousands and tens of thousands. And that is really the secret of the refusenik movement, because it's not the number who have refused yesterday, it's the question mark over how many may be liable to refuse tomorrow. And that is what has this enormous political impact, which is totally out of all proportion to the actual numbers. I agree with you. The numbers are not big. But, for instance, I spoke with a guy who organized this letter from the pilots. And he said he got 27 signatures, but he spoke with 100 pilots. 100 pilots. 27 signed. 73 listened. Didn't sign, but maybe tomorrow they would sign up. And that is the kind of a figure which terrifies any military command when they consider that the army will simply refuse to fight.
And what does the organization that you work with, Yesh Gavul, do to support refuseniks? As we already talked about, there's a fair amount of social ostracism, sometimes even their own families refusing to help them and support them through it, and even abandoning them altogether. I'm not saying that's always the case, but as you mentioned, it is with some of these folks. What does your group Yesh Gavul do to support the refuseniks in Israel?
Well, it begins with small things like solidarity vigils outside the military prison, which is situated at the foot of the Carmel Mountains near Haifa. And when the refuseniks in that prison, we organize vigils where we go up the mountain so that we can be seen over the walls of the prison, and we haul loudspeakers and public address systems and banners up there and to send them a message of support. You're not alone. There are people out here who appreciate what you've done. So there's that kind of publicity and, of course, political work. And a lot of educational work, a lot of educational work among young people who tend to get brainwashed by the military into going along with everything they're told to do. And we try to teach youngsters, don't obey orders. Don't be a robot. When you become a soldier, you're not a machine. You're a citizen in uniform. You have moral, political, and legal responsibilities for the things you do. And this goes back, I should mention, of course, that this has to do with modern Jewish history, because we remember the denazification trials of the late 40s when German officers justified their actions that they committed with this damning phrase, I was just a soldier, I was just obeying orders. And we say no soldier in any army, in any country, under any circumstances, should simply be a robot just obeying orders. A soldier has a brain, has a conscience, and has a duty to scrutinize those orders and under the proper circumstances to say, no, this is unacceptable.
I've been speaking with Peretz Kedron. He is the editor of the book Refusenik, Israel's Soldiers of Conscience, and he's also the international contact for Yesh Gavul. Again, that's in Hebrew, means there is a limit. And they were founded at the time of the invasion of Lebanon in 1982. The group has become the voice and campaigning vehicle for the so-called refuseniks, Israeli Army reservists who report for duty when summoned but refuse morally objectionable assignments, particularly in the West Bank and Gaza. The website for the group, Yesh Gavul, Peretz?
Yesh Gavul? Yeah, well, it's just Yesh Gavul, YESHGVUL.org.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me today, Peretz. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you. And my best wishes to Santa Cruz, which is the place I have a great fondness for.
Take care, Peretz.
Thank you.
You have a good evening.
Okay. You too.
Again, Peretz Kedron, editor of Refusenik, Israel's Soldiers of Conscience, speaking with us from his home in Israel. Want to let you know the website for Yesh Gavul, the Refusenik support group that we were talking about, is YESHGVUL.org. That's YESHGVUL.org. And there you can read statements from refuseniks, you can see the numbers, you can support them, you can read news of the Lebanon situation, Gaza, you can see articles and photos at yeshgavul.org. And there at the website on the homepage, it says, we, candidates for service and soldiers in the IDF, Israeli Army, men and women, as responsible citizens, hereby declare that we will take no part in the continued oppression of the Palestinian people in the occupied territories, and we will not participate in policing actions or in guarding the settlements. There are things that decent people don't do. Yesh Gavul, Israeli support group for the refusenik movement. It means there is a limit.